You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Thursday, January 15th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, journalist, human rights attorney, and author Scott Horton on his latest book, Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Foreign Policy. Also on the program today, the president announces details of paid sick leave, at the very least, for federal workers, tosses it to Congress for the rest of us. Travel restrictions, the details are in about Cuba, actually much more relaxed than I had originally anticipated. The clown car gets fatter. Local taxes in a new report shown to favor the wealthy when it comes to how much is paid. Some right-wing nut jobs in the news. Some gun owner group. They actually plotted out the Charlie Hebdo massacre to see if they could have stopped them with their own guns.
Not on my watch.
Not on my watch. And in Boston, I-93 shut down just outside of Boston in Medford by the Black Lives Matter protesters. All that and more on today's program. Folks, I want to get to this this story, just because it's a very quick one. Longtime listeners of this program, well, moderately long-time listeners of this program are aware that one of my pet, one of my favorite theories out there in terms of crime reduction, and by favorite I mean one that I think is the most likely to answer the question, because we have a situation nationally, and it's also been an international phenomenon, on the drop, dramatic drop, over the past 20 some odd years, in crime in urban centers. And Kevin Drum, we had him on, oh gosh, now, this must have been about 2 years ago. We will link to that at Majority FM, to talk about the totality of the research into what it might be. And maybe you've heard me say that I subscribe to the lead theory. That is when unleaded gasoline became law of the land. And there has been a subsequent dramatic drop in crime 20 years following the institution of those type of bans. So he is speaking about a piece in the New York Times that is looking into the dramatic drop in crime in Canada. Now, this is particularly relevant for a number of reasons, aside from the fact that there's some unintended consequences in banishing lead that maybe we didn't anticipate. Very good consequences. But also, particularly when you're talking about policies like stop and frisk, when you're talking about policies like the implementation in New York of the broken windows policy, the idea of getting small street crimes, small tiny crimes, graffiti, jumping a turnstile, selling Lucy's. That's the way to fight crime. And we all know that Rudy Giuliani was the magician who reduced crime. Well, in fact, this theory about lead is gaining more and more prominence. And speaking specifically about Canada, the piece in The Times says Canada, with practically none of the policy changes we point to here, in this, speaking of this country, had a comparable decline in crime over the same period, said Franklin E. Zimring, law professor and expert in criminal justice at the University of California, Berkeley. He described the quest for an explanation as criminological astrology. Yet, Kevin Drum points out that and shows it with a chart that shows the use of gasoline lead in Canada peaked in the mid-70s, began dropping as catalytic converters became more common. Leaded gasoline was banned for good in 1990 and is now virtually gone from the Canadian scene. And there is almost a perfectly parallel drop in crime, which started 20 years after lead emissions began to drop. As Kevin Drum says, this is exactly what you'd expect. When he was doing his piece that we interviewed him on, he showed that crime was down from its peak values everywhere. 31% in Montreal, 36% in Edmonton, 40% in Toronto and Vancouver, 53% in Ottawa. He makes the point that CompStat and broken windows and American drug laws can't explain that. So if you have a chance and you haven't listened to that that episode, go to majority.fm, click on the link, and you can listen to it there. We got to take a quick break. When we come back, Scott Horton. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program the contributing editor of Harper's Magazine and the author of his latest, Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and the American Stealth Foreign Policy. Scott Horton, welcome back to the program.
Hey, great to be with you, Sam.
So let's start with the most obvious of questions. Who are the Lords of Secrecy?
Well, if I have to give you just one portrait to keep in mind thinking of who they are, that would be Dick Cheney, no doubt about it. A Dick Cheney man who sat at the apex of our national security elites for many, many years, White House Chief of Staff, longtime Secretary of Defense, prime defense advisor to a number of presidents, and finally as vice president. He's a great example. He's someone who rose politically using secrets very, very ably. In fact, we know from Angler, the biography that Bart Gellman did of him, that he was so obsessed with secrets, he created his own secret categories and his own stamps, and he used them all the time. And he used secrets to give greater authority to his own views and analysis, and to protect them from criticism. And we saw that very much in the build-up to the Iraq War, when we saw Dick Cheney running around all over the place saying, based on super secret intelligence that he had access to and we couldn't know, that Saddam Hussein was consorting with al-Qaeda and that he was building weapons of mass destruction. And of course, we know subsequently that was all utter nonsense. There was no such intelligence. But to give a broader description, the Lords of Secrecy are the senior figures in the nation's defense and intelligence agencies who have the power to create secrets and who use that power to bolster their own importance and political power, and to ultimately to be the key decision makers on national security issues.
So, I mean, this isn't a pathology, right? I mean, we're not talking about pathology as much as a tactic.
It's a tactic, and in fact, a large part of my book is what I call a sociological investigation. So I go back to the writings of some of the founders of modern sociology as a political science, who studied bureaucracies and the introduction of bureaucracies in Europe in the late 19th century, early 20th century. And in so doing, they found that that secrecy, that bureaucracies loved secrecy, and particularly national security bureaucracies do, and that they systematically use secrecy for legitimate purposes, you know, for national defense purposes and to protect the privacy rights of individuals, but mostly they use them for illegitimate purposes, which is to advance their own careers, protect themselves from criticism, and to claim control over issues that come up and policies that come up, so that only they are the people who are able to speak to these things, and only they are the people who whose judgments count. And of course, what was pointed out particularly by Max Weber, and this is a little bit more than 100 years ago, was that this was systematically at odds with democracy, and therefore it presented a big threat to democracy. And democracy couldn't dispense with secrets, but it did have to closely guard and limit the creation of secrets.
And I want to get to that, because I mean a lot of that ties into the Thomas Drake and also what you're talking about in terms of the what it's done, what this sort of over reliance on secrecy has done to our democracy. But are we at a point now, and you make the argument in your book that we're at a peak secrecy, if you will, and maybe we're not at peak secrecy, but certainly we're at a higher point, or we have a higher concentration of secrecy than we've had in the past in our country's history. Where did that, has it always been the case, or was there a specific point where secrecy was introduced beyond what one would need, and then another point where it became a much more active tool or actively used tool?
Yeah, I think we go through different historical phases. And I'd say, by the way, no doubt about it, we're facing a crisis of secrecy right now. I mean, there are just in terms of raw numbers of secrets, we've never had so many. We've never been anywhere close to having so many secrets. The country's just awash in them. But if we go back all the way to the beginning, we've always had secrets. They've always been a part of our society from the beginning. And secrets have usually been focused around military affairs and some intelligence gathering, and they focused on wartime. So we've had wartime periods when we had secrets and kept them, and then after warfare we sort of threw that out the window and didn't much care. We got to the creation of nuclear weapons and realized, hey, we've got to deal much more systematically and carefully with this technology. because it presents the threat to destroy humankind entirely, and we can't allow it to proliferate. So we're going to put in really special controls, and that's when the, you know, the modern national security state was created in 1947, and we had a much stricter regime of secrets. But I think in 1947, too, Congress and the political sector realized they thought a lot about the threat and risk of creating too many secrets. So they put pretty careful checks on the process, too, and they made sure that there was always plenty of information in the public sector so we could have valid discussions of these things. And I think, you know, we get to the Cold War, we have a sort of rough-and-tumble war over secrets over and over again. We had Vietnam, where we had the Pentagon Papers case. But really, since 9/11 is when we've seen this explode. And in a sense, it's sort of strange, because in the Cold War, we were facing existential threats from a very sophisticated enemy. That really did justify the need for secrets. Currently, we're dealing with non-existential threats from a not very sophisticated enemy. But nevertheless, this is being used to justify a far higher level of secrecy than we've ever experienced before.
And we can measure that by, you know, I mean, I remember one figure that came out when during Chelsea Manning's trials was that there's some 3.5 million people with top clearance of, I mean, that's a lot of people who are, you know, secreted in, I guess. I mean, how do we measure how many secrets there are? Is that a representation?
Yeah, yes. I mean, you know, who's author? And in fact, we have estimates that go up to more than 4.5 million people who are authorized to deal with secret and top secret information in the United States by some counts. And a lot of them are government servants. They're people you would expect in the Department of Defense and in the intelligence community. But a large number of them, a much growing number of them today, are contractors who are working in all sorts of different agencies that produce telecommunications equipment, armaments, all sorts of new technologies. They're also given security classifications. So it's spreading like wild. And I would say some measure of that is not surprising, but then we look at the total quantum of secrets that are prepared. And, you know, we're putting out $11 billion a year just to keep secrets. And every time our experts start going through the stack, they say, look, it's a safe guess that most secrets shouldn't be secrets. But we've created a default situation in which it's better, safer, easier to call everything a secret. Contractors and others feel instinctively that if they write up a report and they put a secret stamp on it, people are more likely to read it than if they don't, right?
Right, of course.
So my work is important, so therefore it's secret.
I mean, I wonder, does the creating and the expansion of the apparatus, right? Now we have like 3-4 million people who have access to special knowledge, theoretically, right? That the rest of us don't. Does that like sort of create a bucket that then sort of creates the opening for those who are using it as a tactic, but also the incentives to create more secrets because you want to, you need to create a hierarchy within that, you know, that sort of realm. I mean, I'm just curious as to how this is happening. Like, what are the driving factors? I mean, I know you also point in your book to the post-Vietnam era, which is in some ways ironic because, you know, we had the first sort of slapping down, I guess, of the CIA at that time, which ostensibly is about sort of pushing back on this secrecy or on the sort of stealth stuff. I mean, how do you walk us through that and that sort of tension there?
Well, let's go back again and look at, you know, how secrecy is used. And on this score, you know, Max Weber really brilliantly analyzed it. And he said, you know, just looking at how it was used during the First World War, he said consistently people who have the power to create secrets use it to advance their own careers, okay? So by saying that their work is secret, they're saying that their work is important. And then by calling it secret, they can hide their work from people who might have a critical or different view of it and will be in a position to effectively criticize it. So they insulate themselves from criticism or a finding that they did something wrong or made mistakes. Then he went on to say, corruption. Corruption loves secrecy. You put a secrecy stamp on it, law enforcement can't penetrate inside of it and find out that something illegal or corrupt has happened. So this is how you found secrecy pervading the defense contracting area with corruption alongside, and the corruption is absolutely thriving. And finally, he says, looking at this whole system, well, actually pretty mediocre and indeed even sometimes stupid people rose to the top of these bureaucracies. And they rose to the top because of secrecy. You know, had everything been out in the open, they couldn't have survived in a situation in which they were being called on their mistakes and errors. So that's a huge risk that you've got with secrecy that you've got to act against. And then if we look in the situation in Vietnam, I mean, Vietnam was the first war in our nation's history that was really stage managed completely by these national intelligence elites. They did it. They didn't want to have a democratic dialogue about it. They avoided it. We had the Tonkin Gulf incident, some resolutions voted, but we never really had the sort of consistent public debate and decision involving Congress to go forward that America had historically had with wars, at least wars when there was time to deliberate and think about them. It was a brilliant war, as David Halberstam said, but it was also stupid in common sense terms. And it was common sense stupid because you didn't have that public discussion. So they had a pretty traumatic slapdown after the Vietnam War. Their wings were clipped pretty badly. They were publicly humiliated. And after that, national security elites, resolved, what can we do to blunt the pressure that comes from public discussion and democratic process? And they, in fact, took a number of steps that were explicitly designed to do that. So one of the points was, people become very upset when brothers and sisters and fathers are sent off to foreign countries to fight and are wounded and killed. They become very, very engaged and concerned about these matters. Let's eliminate the draft. Let's have only a volunteer army. Let's avoid reporting about casualties and fatalities. Let's not have photographs of those coffins returning at the end of the war. Let's not allow reporters to go in and report on these things. And then let's use military contractors rather than men and women in uniform to do this. And let's not give any information about the military contractors that we use. So we saw this steady shift from uniformed military to contractors. And finally, we come to robotic warfare. So, we have our robots, our drones, our technology waging the war. We've developed technologies and we have put a premium on development of technologies that reduce and even eliminate the risk of fatality to American service personnel. And if you look at the Office of Legal Counsel's opinion justifying circumventing Congress and public discussion in connection with the commitment of forces to Libya in 2011, OLC says there, there are no Americans who are at risk of being killed as a result of this, so there's no need for public debate or discussion. That's a pretty outrageous concept, but it reflects exactly what the national security elites have pretty much always thought.
All right, I want to separate a couple of these things because some of the OLC stuff I think is stunning because we saw it. I mean, throughout the Bush administration and into the Obama administration, we basically have the development of secret law in the context of the NSA spying and in the targeted assassination program, and like you say, in terms of Libya. But before we get there, so their response, the response to Vietnam with the idea of like, we're not going to show caskets. We're only going to have embedded reporters. We're going to have a volunteer army. Is that on a spectrum of secrecy? I mean, because it functions to basically say, let's just, out of sight, out of mind. And then you hit a wall where it's just like, not only out of sight, out of mind, but if it's in your mind, we're just going to make sure it's also out of sight, and that's where we draw that line, so that we can basically not have to deal with the messy part of democracy, which is some measure of accountability.
I think that's it hitting the nail on the head exactly. So, you know, it's impossible to say that fatality, the casualty statistics are secret and the public can't know these things. That would just be, that would be so ridiculous that, there are few officials in the Pentagon who would ever try that.
But I mean, on some level, we are close to that, right? I mean, when we have covert operations, we don't even know. Not only do we not know how many people have died in pursuing a certain agenda, we don't even know what that agenda is in the way that we wage war.
Well, that's right. So with respect to disaggregated information, it's denied. But what they've done is systematically make it much more difficult for anybody to get access to that information. So there is just a growing fog of quasi-secrecy. Let's say, it's not formally classified as secret, but it's not transparent. And what we previously had was a policy of publicity. That is, the people have a right to know. We'll give them this information. Alexis de Tocqueville, when he was writing about America in the early 19th century, said, this is the country of astonishing publicity, where the people actually seem to know all sorts of things about their political office holders and their government that we back in France and in Europe don't know. And it produces a different political culture, a political culture which is fundamentally more democratic than we know. Well, he was right about that. And he was right. The publicity was the key element and driving that.
So does de Tocqueville now look at our country and say, geez, what happened, dude?
I think de Tocqueville coming back today would say, America looks a lot more like France and the Ancien Regime.
Right. Somebody dropped
the
ball.
Which is true. It does. I mean, it is a much more secretive government, and it's a much more burdensome, enormous state apparatus that America had back in the period of the early 19th century when he was writing.
But and to a certain extent, there's a certain amount of inevitability, right? I mean, because you're talking about, 20 times, 25 times more, 30 times more people that we have now. I mean, we have a much, much larger society, I guess. I mean, let's move, because there are two arguments that you're making about secrecy. One is, and I want to just stay, one is the implications for democracy. The other is a more sort of, I guess, pragmatic one, is that the secrecy, the sort of the Weber work, where secrecy is corrosive to competency on some level. And that to me is what has always astonished me about the Thomas Drake story. You talk a little bit about that, because I think when we talk about things like Snowden, and we talk about whether or not Petraeus is going to get in trouble for leaking information based upon sort of the precedents that have been set by the Obama administration, I think one thing that is lost is just like, some of this stuff is so the reasons for maintaining secrecy are so sort of mundane. I mean, this is like the Denny's manager stuff. You know what I mean? Where the guy's just like, I'm not going to, it's totally secret. I can't let the wait staff know why I'm doing this. And it's basically because, whatever, he's drinking half the stock or whatever it is. You know what I mean? That's what the Thomas Drake story is to me. It's just sort of covering somebody's ass.
I think that's right. But I go back and just reinforce, you broke things down perfectly. That is, you have to deal with secrecy at several different levels. The top level here is, at some point, too much secrecy means you cease to be a democracy anymore. The people aren't having a say. And the acid test for any democracy is whether the people have a meaningful say about decisions of war and peace. If they don't, you can call yourself whatever you want to call yourself. You're not really a democratic society. And America has, I think, taken great pride historically in always ensuring that there's public debate, public discussion, and some role for the people to have a say about these decisions of war and peace. That's always been a very important part of our a political culture. And it's an area that's slipping away. And the major reason is secrecy. It boils down to this idea. If the critical facts you have to know to make the call are all classified as secret and only a handful of people know them, then you can't have the public discussion about this. You can't involve the public about it. You can't even or don't really want to even involve Congress on it. So then it's only the lords of secrecy and the White House staff who are going to discuss these things and make the calls. So that's a very, very grave development, which I think the developments in Libya in 2011 demonstrate very well. But then the other case is just having a competent, effective, well-run bureaucracy, because we recognize, you know, we're saddled with it. You know, we're not going back to the days of ancient Greece when there weren't bureaucracies. We're going to have bureaucracies. They're going to be an important part of our lives, and it really matters that they are effectively run and well run, and that bureaucrats are not using secrecy to cover up petty corruption, to cloak their mistakes and so forth. And I think the Thomas Drake case is, it's really a great example of someone who was a very noble, effective civil servant who started looking at a program into which billions of dollars were being sunk and said, this is ridiculous. This is corrupt. It's a horrible program. And we have generated within the agency a program that's more effective than that program, that costs us a tiny fraction of it, and it actually works. So what's going on here? There's some sort of corruption going on here. And that got published, revealed. Journalists won awards for it. But people...
Congress shut down the program.
Congress shut down the program, and people at the top of the CIA, at the top of the NSA, and particularly General Hayden, were horribly embarrassed by these disclosures, and I would say had rather suspicious relations and dealings with the contractors that were involved there that had never been effectively explained. And they decided to launch a vendetta against Drake, and they did this saying, oh, he's the man who's leaking information about the PRISM program, which of course he wasn't at all. But, you know, they had FBI agents crawling all over him, working overtime, trying to build a case against him, raiding his house, sticking guns in his face, going after his family and friends and so on. Acts of just gross intimidation, totally unwarranted. And it was because of their fear that some of their other problems would be exposed, problems which were, you know, where they had gone forward with a program that even the senior legal officials in the Bush administration thought was not legal. You know, we had the acting attorney general threaten to resign together with the head of the FBI over that program. So it's a jaw-dropping example of abuse of power and abuse of secrecy. And in fact, the man who is all over the airwaves today, pushing the secrecy agenda, pushing back against the Senate torture report, General Michael Hayden, is the guy who's responsible for all those abuses. And he's, because of secrecy, he's never been held to account before it, and his role has been effectively obscured.
And it also, you know, you make an example of Thomas Drake. You're sending messages, theoretically, to all the potential Thomas Drakes who may become a whistleblower, either out of conscience if you're Edward Snowden, or just simply saying, like, hey, why are we paying, you know, this much for a hammer? Essentially, is what Drake did, and you're sending a message like, you don't mess with the boss.
That's exactly correct, and that's the reason why I argue that the whistleblower statutes that we have in place that address the national security situation don't work effectively, because people, you know, in Washington have been watching for years and seeing that the Thomas Drakes, the people who go forward and say, I'm concerned about corruption or ineptitude, they discover that the instant they go forward and do this, you know, performing a legitimate, laudable social function, they have a cross on their back immediately. They become the targets. Senior figures in the national intelligence apparatus go after them and work very, very hard to destroy these people. So the consequence is nobody wants to go and use these whistleblower channels that have been created by federal law. They're seeing really that the only alternative, frankly, is you go to the press.
Right.
That's the only thing that works.
All right, let's just turn briefly, if we could, to the CIA, because what has gone on with the CIA, and particularly, I mean, I guess today, I don't know if it was today or yesterday, the CIA Accountability Board, head by Evan Bayh, this is not, I'm not making a joke here, the CIA Accountability Board reversed the findings of the CIA Inspector General, who incidentally just resigned last week, that in fact the CIA did not spy on the Senate Intelligence Committee, but the Senate Intelligence Committee did inappropriate things to the CIA. And this is basically, this is them writing the coda to this entire story where nobody gets punished, nobody's held accountable for torture. In fact, everybody involved is promoted. And John Brennan's out there. He is completely unscathed. The CIA has not lost an ounce of its mandate. If anything, it's increased its power. It gets to write the end of this story. And that's it. I mean, to me... And let me ask your opinion on this, Scott. I mean, is this indicative of sort of what people call the submerged state, or that there is a deep state apparatus? Like, in other words, the national security apparatus is essentially it is the only constant. You can, presidents come and go, but we're always here and we tell them what they do.
Well, I think this is another really important development, and I think it does increasingly point to a situation in which the CIA is unaccountable. You know, people break laws, engage in corrupt activities, and do things that are stupid and foolish, and this never has a negative consequence as long as it gained a wink and a nod from senior management of the CIA, which increasingly it does. So does that mean we have a deep state? Yes, that means we're moving very close to a situation where there's a deep state, where there is a part, a very powerful, a very potent part of the state apparatus that's simply not accountable under the law and is entitled to act independently of democratic processes and the law. That's the definition of this term as it's been developed. And I would say they also are exercising incredible political power. So one thing that appears in the background of the Senate Select Committee report is if you look at the chart out the relationship between the CIA and all these other agencies of government, you see all the other agencies deferring to and in awe of the CIA. I would even say they're afraid of the CIA. They don't want to cross the CIA, and that goes particularly for the White House today. So, you know, how does this resemble a democracy? It doesn't at all. And I'd say also, just having read the Bayh report and compared it with what survives censorship from the Inspector General's report, I would say you're like struck immediately at these two documents. The Inspector General's report is a careful, meticulous, critical, objective review of the facts. The Bayh-Bauer report is a shameless, pathetic piece of whitewash. Nonsensical. It starts from the very beginning accepting as a fact all of the claims that were advanced by the CIA against the Senate, accepting absurd legal positions they put forward as correct without any objective or independent analysis of these positions. And you know, it's very, very clear that John Brennan tapped these two people and assigned them to go write a whitewash for him, and that's exactly what they've done. But even there, this report points, all fingers point to John O'Brien. So all these people who engaged in this nefarious and improper conduct, which even this report concludes it was, say that, well, but Brennan told us to do it. He made all these statements criticizing the Senate committee, and he said all these things. And, you know, this appeared to us to be clearance to go do the things we did. You know, who will rid me of this meddlesome priest? That's what it looked like. So they took that as authority to act, and, well, the director authorized it. So end of inquiry. And one thing that, By and Bauer point out is that we were not authorized or directed to investigate John O'Brien. So this is another one of these reports where it's looking down the line of responsibility, not up the line. And Brennan, but I would say Brennan quite plainly is the person who bears responsibility. And the fact that he continues after all of this as director of the CIA, to me, is jaw-dropping.
Yeah, it's of course, we should remind people that Brennan was – there was an attempt that Brennan was going to be made head of the CIA back in the first Obama administration. He was rejected because of his close proximity to the torture regime, which obviously is not – it's not transparent. He says he wasn't involved, but there are others who argue that he was a little bit closer to the to what was going on. He became a counterterrorism advisor and only became CIA director after it was revealed that David Petraeus had a an affair, I guess, is really basically. And we've since seen Petraeus now also gave secret documents to his biographer slash paramour, I guess, just to want to catch people up. He's, I got to say, Brennan, very fortunate guy that he had the opportunity to be head of the CIA after all under those circumstances. And I guess we can leave it there with that.
Yeah, I think, you know, he had a lot of people running around aggressively giving testimony for him, including Harold Coe, but several others as well, saying he was a stand-up sort of guy. He was good. He was reasonable on all these issues. He's sort of the best sort of person you're going to get. And I have to say, wow, you know, I don't think so.
Right. I mean,
you know,
that was the big push with
Brennan. Part of the problem.
But that was the big push with Brennan when he was getting appointed, right, was that he's the guy who's actually going to come in and corral the CIA from its expansiveness.
That's correct. And at the same time, he was telling his friends at the agency that he was going to protect them from any negative repercussions. So I think the assurances he gave to figures who were involved in the torture and black sites program have been borne out as correct. The assurances he gave to folks in the White House, absolutely not. I mean, for instance, one particular promise he made was to pare back the scope of the drone program and to agree to most of this being transited to the Department of Defense. And he made that promise and then absolutely undermined it, so it never happened. So he has in every way been an aggressive advocate for the expansive power and position of the CIA. And we should all go back and look at the National Security Act of 1947 and what it says about the CIA. I think modern readers of that would be shocked to look at what exists in Langley today, because our current CIA has nothing to do with the CIA that was actually created by statute. It's a totally different entity. It has its own army. It has its own air force. Most of its activities focus on operations, not on intelligence analysis. It is the entity that it has desired to create of itself.
I know you've got to get going here, but lastly, let's just focus on the complicitness of the media, but also, it seems to me, the public. I mean, the public at large doesn't seem to care, not just about what's going on in terms of the CIA, but doesn't seem to care about these issues writ large. You know, there just does not seem to be a concern. It's almost as if the public has said, like, we appreciate you're taking it out of sight. That way we don't have to think about it.
Well, I would say, as philosophers have, that interest is contagious. You know, the more you know, the more you're able to put things together, the more you have an analytical perspective, and the more you are interested in engaging and discussing things. So secrecy sucks the oxygen out of the room and leaves people without the information to have a discussion and without the necessary interest to have the discussion to start with. So it becomes self-serving. So you can say, well, the people really aren't interested in this, and therefore we can make all the decisions, and why should we bother bringing them into the process? So the answer is that more information should be available, and more information being available would provoke more discussion and more engagement with the issues and a more sophisticated and better answer and position being taken by the country. That's what it means to be a democracy.
How is that cycle, though, this sort of self-reinforcing cycle, how is that broken? Because, I mean, if it didn't break here, we're now, I guess, less than a year after Dianne Feinstein stood on the Senate floor and gave what Patrick Leahy said was the most important speech he had heard in his, whatever, 20-some-odd years plus as a senator. Basically saying, hey, the CIA spied on us. That's a real problem. I mean, this should theoretically have been some type of constitutional crisis, right? And now it's just like, well, it's all wrapped up. Evan Bayh came out and said they did nothing wrong. The end. I mean, what's it going to take to break this cycle if that didn't do it?
Well, I think, you know, there are certainly some powerful forces working in the world in the opposite direction right now. And one of them is the process of leaking. So, you know, more information coming out demonstrating that, you know, leaders in the national security establishment are misleading the public, are misdescribing these programs, leads to higher levels of skepticism in the public. And an unwillingness to simply accept at face value what they're told also leads to a recognition that Congress is not doing its job properly. And I think we see it having more effect in democratic societies overseas than the United States. Particularly, you look at many of the European states where you see there's no anti-Americanism that I can see, but there's a lot of negative views towards the American intelligence community, the NSA and the CIA. Attitudes there have changed quite a bit. And consumers are having some effect. I mean, consumers, I think, are particularly in Europe, you know, willing to punish Silicon Valley producers who work or collaborate too closely with the NSA and open a back door to them to get private information, because the marketplace will go with other providers who don't do so. And that in turn has an effect on the marketplace. So I think, you know, there are positive forces out there. And for the long term, I'm not entirely pessimistic about this, but, you know, it's going to be a long, slow, difficult road.
Scott Horton, contributing editor to Harper's Magazine, author of the latest Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite in America's Stealth Foreign Policy. Thanks so much for your time today. We will link to your new book on majority.fm. Really appreciate the time.
Hey, great pleasure to be with you, and good luck.
Thank you. You too. All right, folks. Hey, it is your support that makes this show possible. Become a Majority Report supporter today. We cannot do it without you. Interest is contagious, as our guest just reminded us. And so hopefully this program has its moments where it puts a contagion into the air and infects people. Maybe that's not necessarily the best way to put that, but and you can contribute to infecting others with interest about how our government works and whether it's functioning properly in regards to secrecy or policy or whatnot by supporting this program. Go to jointhemajorityreport.com now, or you can just go to majority.fm to join the program, to support the program. Pennies a day, folks. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. It's great coffee. And if you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. You go to majorityreportkickback.com, click on the Amazon link, buy your crap through there, bookmark it, always buy your Amazon crap through there. We get a kickback. Thus, we bought the URL. At no tiny expense, ladies and gentlemen. There's a lot of negotiations going on. There was a huge auction for majoritypreportkickback.com. I subsequently found out that I was auctioning against Matt, who had been squatting on that site for a long time.
I made so much money off that domain, man.
It was a very clever, clever ploy when I said, like, what should we call this? And you said, here's a list of ideas I came up with, which actually just happened to be the list of the URLs you owned. And
a lot of Monster Energy drinks in those domain names, buddy.
Apparently. That's why you started coming in with the 16-ounce Monster Energy drinks instead of the 12-ounce. MajorityReportKickback.com. All right, folks, 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number if you want to be a part of this program. Or you can IM us. Hey, get the app, MajorityApp.com. It's free, iOS, Android. Then you can just IM us with one button. But if you don't have a smartphone, or if you don't desire a free app because you've got so many free apps, why would you want another one? You can just IM us through your instant messaging client. We're at Majority FM. All right, folks. See you on the flip side.
Ask her to